There's a river somewhere. So much needs fixing around the globe.
Do you draw the line?
And next door.
You and I. All that's broken from the river.
It is time for We Act Radio's Conversations Toward Repair. Welcome. This is We Act Radio, broadcasting from historic Anacostia, Washington, D.C., land that was once home to Nacotchtank people, sometimes called Anacostan, who were displaced within about 40 years of Europeans arriving. Anacostia again faces displacement as newer, more upmarket building increases and longstanding businesses and residents find it harder to survive. Displacement is just one form of structural violence discussed as part of this Conversations Toward Repair series. In this series, we've looked at global, national, and local issues. And today's topic, the U.S. Marshals Service, spans national concerns and local, especially with the shooting death of Alante Scott in D.C.'s Ward 8, where We Act Radio is located. I am Virginia Avniel Spatz, and my intention in starting this series was to focus on undoing violence by making more apparent forms of violence that frequently go unremarked, and by highlighting ideas for building community and for building peace. My guest today is Dr. Matthew Fogg, retired U.S. Marshal, actually Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal, and founder of Congress Against Racism and Corruption in Law Enforcement. I first met Marshal Fogg very briefly during the Voices of Grief and Struggle events in December 2014, which was organized here in D.C. to call attention to decades of law enforcement brutality around the country. Our paths have crossed in intervening years, but this is my first in-depth conversation, and I'm really pleased that we can offer it to We Act Radio. Marshal Fogg has been working on the national level to draw attention to issues involving the U.S. Marshals Service, where he served for 30 years, beginning in 1978. He's been calling attention to discriminatory practices within the Marshals Service and in the communities where that discrimination then influences how marshals interact with people on the street and in serving arrest warrants. He also stands with local groups seeking transparency and reform. And one of those is locally the family of Alante Scott, who was killed by U.S. Marshals in D.C. in February of this year. And as I mentioned, Dr. Fogg is founder of Congress Against Racism and Corruption in Law Enforcement and active with other coalitions locally. So with that, I will stop talking and say, welcome, Marshal Fogg. And why don't you tell us a little bit more about your background and any other things that you'd like our listeners to know?
Thank you very much, Virginia. I appreciate that for having me on board. Yes, I basically, well, I'm a Washingtonian. I was born and raised here in D.C. and grew up, and I was also part of the March on Washington. I was a young kid, 11 years old, marched down to hear Dr. King's famous speech and so forth. And then I had an opportunity to be a part of segregation in this city when we couldn't, I always remember we couldn't get in the Washington branch, Eastern Branch Boys Club because it was whites only. And one day I went home and asked my mother why they won't let us in the Boys Club. I realized later on she was trying not to break me the way she was explaining it. But the bottom line, she was saying there were laws that we had to do what these laws told us to do, she said. And but they're abomination before God. She said, and don't you ever let nobody tell you you're not as good as any other kid. I didn't quite understand that, but I saw them tears flow down her face, and I never forgot. And then she said, son, maybe one day you'll make a difference. And lo and behold, sure enough, you know, as time went on and the things I began to observe, I started knowing that I had to take up the mantle and do what I need to do. So I went on to college and graduated from Marshall University. That's spelled with two L's. It has nothing to do with being a U.S. Marshal. But I graduated from Marshall University in West Virginia. Got there right after the airplane crash. It wiped out the whole football team. They made a movie, We Are Marshall. My challenges was, I was in electrical engineering, but my prerequisites coming out of schools in Washington, D.C., I just could not compete with those kids up there coming into West Virginia and Marshall University. So in order to keep flunking out, I switched my major to law enforcement, criminal justice administration, not knowing that, I guess, God was preparing me for the journey that I would soon take. So I got my degree in criminal justice in 1976, came out, waited a couple of years. And there was an incident that happened to me when I was a kid that I think had an indelible effect on my life. I got locked up by the Metropolitan Police Department for robbery. And it was when I just turned 18. Now, the strangest thing about it was I was working at the Safeway at the time, and I was a package pickup clerk, myself and another kid there. And a little young boy, about 14 years old, these kids around his age group would come around. If they saw him out there by himself, they would try to bully him, rob him, take advantage of him. They wouldn't mess with him if I was out there or the other employee. One day they did catch him out there by himself. They beat him up, took his money. And so the manager brought him inside and said, just call the police, let the police do a report. So the police officer came and did the report. He knew me, the officer, because that year before I had worked in a summer youth program. And he said, well, Matthew, listen, if we catch these boys, would you know who they are? I said, I know the ones that come around here and bully him. I just don't know their names. He said, well, I'll just put you down and the other employee's name down as a witness. Bottom line is, by that time that story got downtown and the detective took the case over, he somehow got our names mixed up as the witnesses, as the suspects. And at that time, of course, I didn't know then, but Black lives didn't matter back then either. So he came and basically they came to my house and it was a Saturday morning, came in and with everything that I'm going to be doing in the future, the paddy wagon out back, police in the back front yard, shotguns and everything. And they come in and tell my mother's Matthew Fogg here, and my mom's all upset and say, we got a warrant for robbery. And see, my son would never rob me. Now, I've always been a good kid. I didn't have no juvenile record, always try to do the right things, but that didn't matter at the time. And I was really perplexed. And anyway, he took me down the station. He's down there typing, and he's trying to put things together. And then finally, he says, listen, he says, now, he just wants me to just confess, just straight up. Don't even try to figure this thing out. Just say, hey, look, just you did it. You don't have no record, so you'll get out on bond. He's telling me stuff like that. And I said, what did I do? Who did I rob? And finally, he showed me a picture of the boy that I suppose had robbed. And, you know, you just got a relief came over to me at that moment because, you know, it's almost like you go to the doctor and you think you got something really bad. And he said, you just need some Tums or something, but you're scared. So bottom line is he ended up, when he showed me the boy I thought Rob, I'm flabbergasted. I'm like, man, you got the wrong guys. We're the ones who called you and all of that. And you could see a real perplexed look came on his face. He goes away for a real long time. He finally comes back and he sits down all looking all weird, and he says, the boy said you did it. He's telling me that, but I know that boy didn't say that. But see, these are all the things that and God wanted me to experience this stuff because this is what I'm going to be seeing later on in law enforcement, how we do things, how we get our numbers up, how we make arrests, how we can easily alter the evidence, everything to get what we want, the desired result we want. Bottom line is, I told him, man, I know that boy didn't say that. He said, well, you're going to have to go to the cell block until Monday. I didn't know what that was. But then when they took me and they drove us all over to the cell block in the van, dropped us off down there. Now they got to fingerprint me and take my pictures and all of that. And I'm upset now and I'm crying. I want to fight. I don't want this to happen because I'm saying they made a mistake. I shouldn't be getting fingerprinted and all of that. But bottom line is, one of the officers down there, I never get him. He told me, he said, this big white guy, he says to me, he says, look, we fingerprint people two ways here. And I'm thinking maybe one of them is you can go home and come back later with your parents or something. He says, two ways here. He says, conscious or unconscious. You figure out which way you want to do it. And I was in the corner. And then finally, this other officer came over to me and talked to me, a black officer. And he said, listen, kid. He said, usually people don't put up a resistance like this at this stage. He said, I believe you. He said, but there's nothing you can do at this point. You got to go through with this process. He says, and hopefully, he says, when you get out of here, he said, you get your parents and you come back and you fight this thing. He said, y'all sue. He said, because if that's what had happened, what you said has happened, he said, you shouldn't have no police record. So anyway, I went through the process. Then they end up putting me in the cell with some guy. And most people think they put you in the cell with Bubba. In this case, it wasn't Bubba. It was worse. They put me in the cell with a guy that was going through heroin withdrawals. I didn't know what that was all about. The guy's withering around on the floor, holding his stomach, puking, throwing up, going to sleep, waking up, all kinds of stuff. I'm thinking, I don't know anything about drugs and withdrawals, but I did see a werewolf movie. I thought the guy was becoming a werewolf. Honestly, he had all of the attributes and traits of a werewolf that, you know, you see in the movies, all the gyrations they go through before they wake up and hang all over his face. And he was going to do that and then wake up and tear me from limb to limb. So I'm screaming, God, he's a werewolf. Please get him out of here. Finally, one of the other guys in the cell, he says, man, that's not a werewolf. He says, listen, he said, that dude just kicking a cold turkey. Now I'm thinking the guy ate some cold turkey. And I'm thinking, cold turkey do that to you? So I'm like, I will never ever eat any cold turkey if that's what it does to you. You see how naive I was. But the bottom line, they end up taking the guy out. Make a long story short, they end up that Monday, the U.S. Marshals came, guys, because in Washington, D.C., and I'll get into that, U.S. Marshals handled all of the local stuff that normally sheriff's departments handle in most of the other counties and jurisdictions. But U.S. being quasi-federal, U.S. Marshals, the U.S. attorney handles all the prosecutions. Everything comes out of D.C. Superior Court. So when the U.S. Marshals came and got us and carried us over to in a big old bus and loaded us all, carried us over to the Superior Court, I was getting my, you might say, my own hands experience of what I'm going to be doing in the future. Everything to the T. So bottom line was they let us go. Me and the other guy, they let us go right from the basement of the cell block. They took everybody up for arraignment that evening, Monday evening. I was so upset. I wanted to go up and see a judge so I could tell a judge and get the marshal. I never get the way to the marshal. Look here. He said, you know how many people we let go through that door like we letting you go? He said, you need to get out of here before you really do pick up a beat. Nobody cared about how I was feeling, what I was going through. But when I got outside, my dad was there to pick me up. I said, Dad, let me just walk home. I got to think about what I went through. And I went by to see that detective. He's telling me that I won't have a police record. He said, the little boy did say, he said, did you did it? But then he changed his mind. He's telling me all this stuff. And I'm saying, man, look, I'm going to have a police record. He's telling me I won't have one. So bottom line is I end up getting home. Later on, when I go to college, every year I come home, I check to see if I had a record. It said no record found. So I'm feeling pretty good about that and thinking, well, the experience I had. Now I come out. Now I'm looking for jobs in law enforcement. And when I get out of college, I'm looking for jobs in law enforcement. Metro Transit was getting ready to hire me, D.C. Metro Transit. And lo and behold, that record pops up. And it had not only prosecute, but had robbery. So the investigator calls me and he says, Mr. Fogg, what is this? You got locked up for robbery. And I'm looking, I'm like, man, I didn't do it. That was a mistake. He closed the folder just like that and said, we can't hire you. And so, and that's another point I'm going to make here. Because see, all these records that when you put on people, especially black folks, they don't have nobody advocating on their behalf. So a lot of them wind up just walking away. And even though an arrest or something that went down that shouldn't have never went down, or the cop just charging people just randomly in the car, all of these things that they do to get their numbers up. But bottom line is this, I ended up getting the American Civil Liberties Union. They took it over the case and they ended up getting the case expunged. And that was after I wrote a letter to President Jimmy Carter. And then that's how they responded, by having the American Civil Liberties Union jump on it. Bottom line was we couldn't sue because we let the statute of limitations run out. But at least they expunged the record and they gave me the pictures. And to this day, I got the photos with the numbers under me and all that goes in my book at the beginning. Shows the process. But so anyway, I go on. I get a job. The U.S. Marshals end up, make a long story short, they just end up taking me on board. I go to Glencoe training. I get all this training at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center down in Glencoe, and you go through several months of training and, you know, when to shoot, when not to shoot, policies, procedures, everything you're supposed to, how to do everything right in law enforcement and your processing of you know, your job. First thing I hear when I get to my duty station was the manager who was right over the warrant squad. First thing he tells me, he says, Fogg, I know y'all learned all that stuff at the academy. You're all buffed up and ready to go. He said, but let all that stuff go. This is how we do it here. And basically what he was telling me, there's this culture in place. We do things, and if you play within that culture, you'll be okay. You go outside that culture, you have problems. So, because I mean, I was perplexed. I thought I learned all the right ways at the academy. Now you're telling me this is how we do it here. And then that story began to now go over and over again on as I begin to see how things were being done within our operations and stuff that they was doing. And if you saw officers do things that you knew weren't right, you learned real fast. You got to keep your mouth shut, because if you don't, you saw what happened. Other officers open their mouth, and the system has a way of protecting itself. If they don't, even though the officer may be wrong and everybody knows a cop out there may be wrong, you don't speak out because the system doesn't want itself, that, you know, managers and people, they don't want to look bad. So they rather try to deal with it internally than to let somebody expose it for what it really is. And then so somehow they'll make you become the bad guy.
Okay, so let's pause there for just a second, because one of the things that I wanted to do with this radio series on Conversations Toward Repair was to get people who maybe don't think about the kinds of experiences that you had as a young person or trying to get work later with this bit on your record that you'd been told. All of those things, many people know about them, but the way our society is, some of us, because of our skin color or other kinds of privilege, don't experience it directly. And I want to make sure that we just kind of pause and make sure that we are really hearing what Marshall Fogg has just told us about his upbringing here in Washington, D.C. I'm guessing you mean like the Safeway down on 14th Street? Is that the one you were working
on? No, the one was on Kentucky Avenue on Southeast D.C.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So, yeah, that and the Eastern branch of the Boys and Girls.
I grew up in Southeast.
Yeah. So that's several blocks from where I live now. And I've been here for 35 years. But my children, who are both white, had a different experience than many of their friends. And I just feel like we need to sometimes just kind of pause and say, okay, this is serious.
That's right.
Business. And this
and it happens all the time.
It is there. And some of us can kind of avoid even thinking about it. And that's the point of the show, is to make sure that we are not doing that. So with that, I really thank you sharing the experience that you told. And it was a wonderful, engaging story, and also heartbreaking, and you know, the cold turkey, like you thought it was going to be a werewolf. That's, you know, like, yeah. I do understand, you know, kids who have not experienced law enforcement directly are really naive when they're brought into the system and they find out quick that there's no room for that.
So
now we're up to, you've gotten a job with the Marshal Service, and you've already been told that everything that you were taught and everything that the outside world, if they review documents about how the U.S. Marshal Service works, you know, we're going to be told that that's what happens. But in reality, it's a different story. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but when did you file your individual lawsuit?
EEO complaint, Laws Equal Employment Opportunity Discrimination complaint. That was in 1985. I came on in 78. And the strangest thing was they made me an EEO collateral duty investigator in 19, that would have been probably right around 80, 81. So they sent me all the training schools. And then what I was doing was simply helping people in time somebody filed an EEO complaint or something as a collateral duty. My job was to help them to process that complaint, which taught me all of the procedures, because a lot of times if you've got a filing discrimination complaint or you've got that going on, it can be a challenging and it can be a sort of process that sort of can turn you off, make you run away from it or don't know how to handle it. So I had all that experience. So then what happened is in 1985, we had a white manager who was known to be a racist, known to be discriminatory towards African-Americans, but they was trying, he became a chief. And he was known to, basically, if you were an astute individual, you had something on the ball, he would try to do something to mar your career and mess you up. So bottom line was for me, one day I was on a special assignment. My career, I was doing very well. I was moving up fast and everything. And I was on a special Bernard Welch Hugh Colon task force. I didn't want. And what happens is the U.S. Marshals had this 15 most wanted fugitive manhunt task force. And like the FBI has their 10 most wanted. So these are the most wanted people. Whenever somebody makes that most wanted list, then they put resources out of headquarters and dump more resources into having the task force fugitive stuff to look for these people and try to find them, because, you know, of course, they're anywhere in the United States. Bottom line was, I was working on that task force when this manager somehow told a lie on me and said that I took a government vehicle and left the thing and went home and didn't tell nobody. And all these things he said. So that's a serious offense in the government, unauthorized use of a government vehicle. Serious offense, and you can get fired behind that. Definitely get some serious time on the street. So all these are things that when that popped up, the head marshal was a black man. He was a little concerned that here it is. I had this this young guy with a degree at that time and moving up and doing well. Now all of a sudden he's got these things that the chief is telling him that he did. So he said, well, look, don't really try to hurt Fogg in that sense of reporting internal affairs. He said, just pull him off the task force and send him back to Superior Court. Now, on every job in the Marshal Service in any place, there's always what we call a Siberia. There's always somewhere least desired work people want to do in that particular local job. Ours was DC Superior Court. You didn't want to work in Superior Court because just a lot of, they didn't have the manpower. It was everything that we was dealing with, mostly black subjects coming through, arrestees. It was just chaotic until they started bringing white deputies in. Then they changed all of that. But this shows you how the discrimination, again, everything had this sort of racial overturn tone on it. So bottom line was, I filed an EEO complaint against this individual in 1985. And when I filed that complaint, and a lot of people didn't want me to file it because they said, Fogg, that's going to mar your career. We don't do it. You don't need, just let it go. Let it go. I said, man, no. The things this guy did, we need to expose him because he's doing it to other people. We filed the complaint. At that time, the complaint, not much happened with the complaint. Things went on. Then at one point in time, they was trying to make this same manager become a presidential appointed U.S. Marshal, because they split the district. Now district court was separate from D.C. Superior Court, two different districts. So they wanted a head marshal. The marshal, the way the hierarchy works is when you're over a district and you become the U.S. marshal, now you are appointed by the judge and through the attorney general and that type of thing. I'm not a judge, but by the president of the United States. So it's a political process. And then everybody under them are career employees with chief deputies and everybody else. But that marshal is the presidential appointee. So what happened was, I went up on Capitol Hill and told them why this guy should not be a U.S. Marshal. Now, you know, so now I'm going to slay a giant. Bottom line was, the guy happened to go to a retirement party where two black guys were retiring out here at Bowling Air Force Base. And he told a joke about coons. And he told it in front, thinking if, you know, he could just tell that joke and everybody laugh it off. But it wasn't really funny to the head marshal and the other people, but it was about these two guys about raccoon hunting, and they shoot a raccoon up into the tree. The raccoon doesn't fall out of the tree. They got a dog with them named Blue that's trained to bite the genitals off a raccoon if he catches them. So you got castration going on here. Got a lot of elements in this thing. One of the marshals climbs up the tree to try to shake the raccoon out. He starts to fall to the ground. He yells to the other marshal to shoot the dog, shoot Blue. So that's insinuating that the dog is going to think he's a coon. So he tells that joke, and he tells him he's laughing. But that joke, believe it or not, now, me being a practitioner for EEO and learning all of the process, when I went to Capitol Hill, I had documented evidence of all these other incidents that I thought, you know, could culminate into showing why this guy had racial animus towards African Americans. They weren't concerned with none of that. But they said, is there anything else you could tell? So I thought the coon joke was the least of it. But I told them about the coon joke, and they said, well, is there anybody to validate that? I said, yeah, check with U.S. Marshal. He'll validate. Make a long story short, they did. And he validated. He said, no, he thought it was very distasteful. So that stopped his nomination. They just told him, they told the chief, they said, look, we're not going to end it, but we want them to investigate Fogg's EEO complaints and see where that turns out. He said, well, I'm pulling my name out the hat. I'm just going to go ahead and retire. Because he was at a retirement age. He said, I'm just going to retire. And so what happened? I just slayed a giant. But again, in the hierarchy of things, when you do something like that, you become a whistleblower. You're speaking out now. Now you've got the other people in the hierarchy, friends and buddies of this person. Now you become a target, and they're interested in how can they get you. So that's when the career started with those issues. But in the meantime, I went on and started doing well. I got assigned to a task force, DEA task force. I'm out there. I'm doing my job. I'm making a lot of arrests. But this is when I started noticing that the war on drugs was racially motivated, because when I was working with DEA, I noticed that all of the drug and gun interdiction task forces that we were setting up from headquarters all the way down to our individual offices was all centered on urban areas and Black neighborhoods. Now, we know when you begin to see, because I'm going to tell you, I didn't know too much about drugs until I went off to college and I was around a lot of white students. Man, they had drugs up the yang yang. I mean, it was drugs everywhere. They were growing marijuana, everything you could. I had never heard of some drugs when I got to West Virginia until they was talking about these types of drugs. And so, but none of our interdiction was going into the white neighborhood. So one day I had, when they were setting up one of our, we would do these dragnet operations where we'd take like 6-7 cities and we hit Chicago, New York, Miami, LA. We set up these operations and then we go 90 days and see how much drugs, guns, and arrests we can make, and we get with the state and locals, and we these U.S. Marshal task forces, which you're going to hear about later about some of these shootings on these task forces. But we would marry up with the state and locals, and we would deputize all of them, and then we run these task forces across the country. And what I saw was I began to notice one day how, like I said, everything was targeting urban areas. So I asked the special agent in charge, I said, don't they sell drugs out in Potomac and Silver Spring? I'm using Maryland. I'm using areas in this, in our area. I said, don't they sell drugs in those areas and stuff? He said, yeah, Fogg. He said, but listen, let's be real about this thing. He said, if we go out there and start kicking their doors in and doing all the stuff that we do in the ghettos and the urban areas, he said, they know judges, they know lawyers, they know politicians. He said, what's going to happen? We're going to get a phone call and they're going to shut the operation down. He said, there goes your overtime and everything else you're making. He said, just stick to the weakest link, man, and roll with it. So at that point, I realized now what we've got is ethnic cleansing, because now if I can't go after everybody, this is not an equal opportunity enforcement operation. Now it's selective enforcement, you know, what we call, you know, everybody racial profiling, all of those things and more above. But that's what we began to operate, and that's how we began to do it. And if you did speak out like I did, now you become a whistleblower. Now they start to look at you cross-eyed. So those are some of the things that I started noticing. And then as things went on, of course, they left me on a stakeout. They killed. Once my case started developing more and more and more over the period of time, then they found a way to fire me. But before that happened, I was on America's Most Wanted task force. We were doing very well. We were trying to catch this guy. I didn't want to run the task force because the white guys that was running it before me, I knew they would have a problem taking orders from me. But the boss put me in charge because at that time we had arch row between us and the FBI. They didn't want the FBI locking up our fugitives. And they found out, the FBI let them know, they had an informant that might know where our fugitive is. So they called me up and said, Farr, we want you to take over the task force. I did take it over. It took me three. They had been looking for him for almost, I think it was like something like 11 months, some crazy number. It took me 3 weeks to get him. But when I did catch him, the very day I caught him, the white guys who was under my command control, they left Baltimore. We caught him over in Baltimore. They left Baltimore, went all the way back to Washington, D.C., and told the boss, told the headquarters guy that I was on a wild goose chase. I didn't know what I was doing. All this crazy stuff. At the same time, I get a phone call right before we end up catching Michael Lucas, was the guy's name, before we caught Michael. I get a phone call from the deputy commander headquarters. He said, Fog, the boss is going to pull the task force back from you because he just doesn't want to deal with any more of the, you know, the scuttlebutt, the noise that he's hearing. So I told him, I said, well, he the one put me in charge. I said, he said, the only thing I can tell you is you got 3 days, Fog. Lock the dude up between, he said, MF. He said, lock him up between now and that Wednesday. And after I hung up from him, that's when I got a phone call from one guy that was watching a particular location. We went to that location, and we ended up getting Michael Lucas. But the crazy part about it was, on that arrest, I did something I'd never done before, but it saved my life, and it probably saved his as well. Because he was rabid at that time. He was, like, determined he was not going back. He escaped that. They had escaped, went over the wall with sheets and all that stuff, you know, something you see in a prison break movie. And they were on the run. So he was determined. He was doing 20 to life for murder, for killing a guy on the streets of Washington, D.C. He wasn't going back. So when the time came for us to make the arrest, my guys, you know, couldn't ID him. They'd ride up next to him in the vehicle before Lucas stopped at a corner, him and another guy. They rode him, looked right at him, couldn't ID him. So it made me have to go out there. And the Lord, just like the Spirit just said, man, this one's going to kill. You got to go get him. So I told everybody, watch me. I'm walking down the street. I walk past Lucas. He follows me around the corner because he feels like I'm the police. They can literally smell you on the street. They know the police. I don't care how much you look undercover. He followed me, and when he saw me walk up to another marshal with my wallet open, he thought we were in a high-crime drugger. He thought I was just copping drugs. And when he saw that, and he stood off at a distance, but he watched me, he said, because he told me all this later, then he just turned his back to walk away like we're no threat. I'm telling the other marshal, it is him. Let's take him. So as we're turning around, we're pulling our guns out. I see Lucas walking with his back to me. I walk straight up on him. I've never done. Normally, you draw down, you say U.S. Marshal, all of that. That would have given him, he was holding a gun in his pocket, a 380, 9mm 380. He was holding it in his pocket. He would have pulled that gun out and would have took a shot and probably would have got me because it would have took me a second. I know me before I would have squeezed off a round. But the bottom line was I stepped physically in front and I grabbed his pocket. I held that gun in his pocket. He couldn't get it out. We got him subdued and finally we got him arrested. And that was a big story and all that. And I said, now you charge them guys with insubordination, leaving, desertion, everything. My boss tells me, Paul, can we just let bygones be bygones? So you see, that's the type of thing that you're under when you're in this command and control environment. They expect for you to do it the way they want it done, whether it's right or wrong, and that includes management. And so it gets to a point where the culture gets out of control because then we determine who, what evidence we're going to display, what evidence we ain't going to display. They had a little under all these little underlining things they tell you. Always make sure you got a weapon you carry with you that can't be traced back to you. So if you get into a shooting or something, you throw that weapon down. These are all the culture things we were doing. They tell you if you lock somebody up, the drugs weren't on them, say the drugs weren't on, even the drugs weren't on them. It was laying on the ground or something or whatever in the car. You stop a car, got four blacks in the car. One boy got drugs on them, you charge them all. You know, now that record, that's going to get thrown out, but they're going to have the same problem I had. They're going to have records that's going to say Nolly prosecute or whatever. That happened thousands of times in America. So when you talk about racism and the war on drugs, I begin to see it across the board. And it was almost like we were just doing it without even thinking about it. But, you know, the disparate impact we were having on the black community was outrageous. but nobody was caring because Black lives really didn't matter. You just got your arrest numbers up. It looked good when you're making a lot of arrests. It looks like you're out there doing what they want you to do. But again, as long as the targets was urban and Black people, if we had been doing that to white folks, they would have fixed this thing a long time ago. Said, whoa, wait a minute. What are you doing here? Somebody would have been speaking out and doing something about it. As long as it wasn't about people who had the privilege, then nobody really cared. They heard people complain about the disparate impact and the racial injustice and racial problem. You hear it all the time. But until, you know, and when they saw George Floyd and they actually saw it on camera, then all of a sudden everybody came out, the pandemic, people weren't working. So the stars lined up for all them people to come out the way they did. But bottom line is, it's just like I testified just recently at the General Assembly for Maryland on a particular bill called the Marijuana Odor Bill. And that bill was to change the law so that cops just couldn't walk up your car and say, I smell marijuana. And then they got full right to search you and do all that. Well, I testified against that bill. But I never get, I'm in the General Assembly, and this one guy, one of the legislators, he happened to be a cop, a police officer as well. And he said, Mr. Fogg, look, he said, I got a question. From all this, he said, you came on in 1978. He said, don't you think things have changed since you came on? So I said, well, look, let me answer that question. Let me think for a second. And so I thought, for sure, everybody's looking at me. And then I looked down at my cell phone and I said to him, yeah, things have changed. I said, yes. I said, this here. Mm-hmm. I said, Trust me. I said, they beating them up and charging them and doing everything they was doing in 1978. I said, just today we're getting it on camera. Mm-hmm. And he had to just kind of quietly back off because that's what George Floyd and all the rest is about. It's now you're seeing it on camera and people are seeing these things happen. So with the Marshal Service, so with my lawsuit, I take it to court. They ended up firing me. They fired me in 1995. So all that was a part of my lawsuit when I went for saying, hey, you know, I blew the whistle. They terminated me. They did all these things to me. We go to federal court and we win. We don't settle. We go all the way to a jury trial, and the jury trial finds it. And not only does the jury finds in my favor, but the jury comes back and says, we find the whole U.S. Marshal Service to be a racial, hostile environment for all of us African-American deputies before and after 1991, I believe. But the bottom line was showing the longevity of this racism. So once I won, that was in 98, you would have thought the agency would have backed them and said, okay, we've been exposed, let's fix this. Oh no, they came after me. Even the judge turned on me. He wouldn't even, under Title VII law, you have to make a person whole if a Title VII jury says the agency was wrong. You got to follow the jury verdict. He says, let the appeals court tell me I'm wrong. Knowing that's going to take another couple of 2 to 3 years, which it did. Then he steps down off the bench. And then they sign up. Make a long story short, it took 10 years from the time that I won to the time I got paid in 2008. Wow. So continue. In the meantime, in 1994, while I was going through this stuff, my attorney, we got together and he said, look, Fogg, you should file a class action because all this stuff that you're exposing, this is happening to all of the Black deputies. So just file a class. He said, my firm won't be able to represent you. He says, but the thing about it is at least you'll have it on file and then you can take it from there. So I went on and filed it. Now, I know a lot of people wouldn't have because at that time, a lot of Blacks, a lot of people was running away from me. Was scared of me, didn't want to be around me, didn't want to have nothing to do with me. When I went to trial, it was, man, you would have thought I had bubonic plague, and SARS, and a little bit of COVID on the side. You know what I mean? I mean, that's the way people treat you. So reality was, I filed that in 94, and 95, they fired me. We went to trial, we went in 98. The jury says Matthew Fogg would have reached the level of Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal in 1998 at the time of trial, and all of these things, and the courts turn around and try to reverse every bit of that, and then put me in. And then the government, when they finally paid me in 2008, they held all of my withholdings, federal taxes, state taxes, and other withholdings, they held it in a slush fund, didn't tell the IRS, issued me a 1099 and said no tax was taken out. Then the IRS started coming after me.
Wow. Wow. So let's pause for another second. And I want to remind listeners that this is We Act Radio, broadcasting from historic Anacostia, Washington, D.C. I'm Virginia Avniel Spatz. And the other voice you're hearing is Dr. Matthew Fogg, who is Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal retired. And we've been hearing a lot of stories from his long experience with the U.S. Marshal Service. And given that we only have about 20 minutes left here. So I'm wondering if we should pivot to talking about some of the cases that you're trying to draw attention to right now. There is, of course, there is the class action suit, which is maybe we should set that aside because I think that might be another whole topic. Right. And there's also the case of Alante Scott here in Washington, D.C., who was unfortunately just in February. So while Dr. Fogg has been calling people's attention to these problems for decades, marshals are still on the street shooting a fleeing suspect in the back. From reports, the young man was trying to dump the garbage when they wanted to serve a warrant, and he ended up killed by U.S. Marshals. And then there was MPD on the street later saying that he'd been armed and involving themselves sort of after the fact. So I want to pause and just ask if you want to say something about the Alante Scott case, or if you have other current cases that you want to mention before our time gets away from us.
Right, I understand. No, yeah. And it all connects to what I'm saying. I mean, if you see right behind me, there's a sign that says Bigots with Badges. And that's the New York Post in 1997. They did a story, and they did it comprehensive for your readers, for your listeners. They can go to that bigotswithbadges.com, to that website, and get a full story. But that's really the gist of the Marshal's Office, with that history of bigotry and racism. So the bottom line became, and just like when I was telling you about the disparate impact and how the racial profile, all the ways we conducted our activities, everything had a disparate impact on black culture, whether it's New York City, Chicago, LA. And I work with a lot of dragnet operations in all these cities. So I just didn't work in Washington, D.C. So I got a chance to see across the board and how law enforcement interacted with black people, period. So we talk about the extraordinary and the disproportionate numbers of killing of blacks or just arrest and all of the stuff that we do. The whole law enforcement system was centered on, like I said, get your numbers up on people of color, people who lives don't matter. So in the Alante case, when you look at that, and I spoke at his funeral, and I said, what we do know, I read a poem. I said, what we do know is this. The Marshal Service is riddled with racism. It's a racial hostile environment. A judge found it, said it was occult racism. He said it in my hearing, in my case, and we've heard it over and over again. So there's nothing you can believe coming out of the Marshal Service when it comes down to race issues, when it's white versus black. I'm sorry, you just can't believe it. And when they tell us that this man supposedly had a gun, I don't know. I know, like I said, our culture said, that unspoken word was you carry a throw down weapon. We have no idea. I just know that it seems like a lot of these incidents that we see are disproportionate. Well, they don't seem like it. Statistics prove it's disproportionately affecting black people. So in Alante Scott situation, we've got the government saying they don't want to release the video right now. But yet we just heard of another, a young man was killed in Virginia. What was his name again? The marshal, the one in...
Frank Jennings.
What's his name? Jennings. Yeah, Jennings, right. Frank Jennings. This young man was killed under questionable circumstances, and the prosecutors up there just came out, I think yesterday, just released their report that they were not going to indict or charge these guys. Again, no, I've been in law enforcement. I'm the first one to say, look, if we're right, we're right. If we try to protect our lives and somebody's trying to hurt us, we have a right to defend ourselves. But there's so much stuff that now pops up that says our credibility is at stake. And somebody said, you have just a few bad apples. And I always say, you can't say that in law enforcement, because if you got a few bad apples and you can't tell me which ones they are, they're all bad apples. That's the way we got to look at it. And so reality of it is that Alante Scott's case is one that we're saying you need to release the videos. Don't wait and stop putting it off. There must be something going on that you don't want the public to see. So again, and then we're talking about many other incidents across the board. And as long as the U.S. Marshals Service in the class action, it's been going on, what, 30 years now, 1994 till present. So you're talking about 30 years of racism, bigotry, everything you can think of. And you say, how in the world can the president just came out with an executive order, 74. Executive order on policing. And the reason why he came out with that executive order, because he was trying to address the fact that they could not pass the George Floyd Policing Protection Act in Congress. So that was his sort of response to that. Well, if Congress can't pass, I'll come out with an executive order. Well, your executive order is a good direction, but it needs teeth in it. Because just like myself, if guys want to come forward, and there are a lot of cops, believe me when I tell you this, they want to come forward and point out the bad cops because they know who the bad. I tell people, cops know who the bad cops are. The civilians don't have to tell me that. We work around these people. We know the ones who are out there doing these things. We know the systems that are in place that creates these atmospheres of what you call cultures of indifference, where you see us constantly locking these people up and they happen to be of one color. It makes you think you would think they're the only ones that use drugs. We see how we, when it comes down to the prosecutors, and they overcharge a lot of these people with these drugs and then take them and say, if you don't tell us about somebody else, then we're going to put more time on you. And all of this, and it becomes this vicious cycle of indifference in law enforcement. But yet all of the people, especially anybody who goes up the rank like myself, anybody in the rank, you are expected to toe the line and go along to get along, and you don't speak out and you don't bring up the issues that needs to be addressed. So all that's a part of this whole culture that we're in, and the Marshal Service is leading the show, which we fall under the Department of the U.S. Department of Justice, which is the lead law enforcement agency in America. So if we're doing it, and it's in our backyard, then how can the executive order do anything if you got all of this outstanding racism in-house, in the backyard? How are you going to go out there? Of course, if I'm a bigot, if I got to work next to a bigot with a badge and he's working with me, you know what he's going to do to the public. I don't even have to even tell you that.
So I did want to ask a few more questions about your experience with talking to the Scott family, right, and tell listeners who may be don't know that in at the end of February, there was this attempt to serve a warrant. Alante Scott was shot 7 times in the back, was killed by U.S. Marshals, and then MPD showed up to investigate. And the police department has told me they were just called because there was a sound of shots. That's what they say. And I know that you had some conversation with the family, and that what was said in the press conference, which some of us know is already trying, you know, already the chief of police in DC is going to try to criminalize a person who has been killed by law enforcement officers.
Right.
And we heard from Deputy, I think it was Dixon, in that press conference, one of the reporters said, well, what were you serving the warrant for? And the marshal said, well, that's not important, and wouldn't say anything about that. And then there was this issue of the gun. So can you tell us a little bit about what you heard?
Well, the bottom line is this, and I'm just talking to some of the family members. They mentioned to me that were on the scene at the time that, and this was sort of like they said, it was a spontaneous reaction. But the lead investigator at the time, I guess, that was doing the investigation had said, when Conte, the chief of police, was giving the news conference, all of a sudden he mentions a gun that supposedly the suspect, there was a gun found at the scene, and they said, the lead investigator, like, oh my, this is the first time hearing about a gun, sort of like reacted that way. Like, you know, gun, we hadn't heard about no gun before. Now, this is all, again, sort of like hearsay in the sense of saying that somebody is saying this, the spontaneous reaction. But my point is, again, when you're talking about law enforcement covering each other, because we're going to cover for the marshals, the local PD is going to cover for us because they get a lot of money from the Justice Department and to cover their services. So everybody's covering each other. But let me be clear on the videos. First thing, no, the U.S. Marshals, they don't wear body cameras, so they didn't video it. That video came from all those street cameras that are up. So if MPD had access to those guys, and the Justice Department would have access to that stuff too, they're the ones who should be saying, okay, well, we've got access, we've seen the videos, let's release what we have. But the bottom line is nobody's releasing this stuff. And are we going to have a situation just like we just had today or yesterday where they finally released a video after they said the cop, the marshals did nothing wrong? That video didn't come out till yesterday. So in this incident, I understand it happened a year or so ago. So again, what we're having here is we're saying all of this brings the credibility of the Marshal Service and the Justice Department into play. You know, can you trust me? And if you don't have public trust, everything's gone. And you don't have public trust. I can say that right here and now. You don't have public trust in law enforcement. And clearly, when you got a bunch of bigots with badges working with you, you don't know who they are and where they are, then that brings everything into question. So in essence, those were some of the things that I had heard.
And you've already had one press conference with the Scott family back, I guess it's 2 weeks ago now, and I think you're planning another one. What else would you like people to know in order to inform themselves about this case, about your ongoing work, so they can get involved?
Well, what we would want people to understand, though, first, go to the website, understand that we've got this class action that's in play. And right now, I'm concerned about the direction that's going in. And I need public support to help us because I know the direction we need to be going. And I'm the one who filed the complaint. I'm the one who's been with it all these years. I understand the mechanism of law enforcement. As far as the people that we're harming on the street or we having anything to do with it. And again, I'll say this with the Lante case. I don't know all of the intricate details when the marshals jumped out the car and what they actually did and physically did. I just know right now, there's this question about whether or not you can't trust law enforcement because of the racial problems that are going on internally. And I'd say you cannot trust us. So therefore, that's a big issue right now, and it needs to be resolved. And I came forward with 7 resolutions that I put out there. And you'll be able to go to my website, Bigots with Badges. I'm going to put them up, put the press release out there and so forth, that you'll be able to understand and see what it is that we want. And we definitely want them to deal with qualified immunity. Officers, when they're reckless and out of control, should not just get straight up qualified immunity and be immune. They should be sued, just like you can sue doctors and lawyers when they mess up and are reckless. We're talking about whistleblower protections. Cops who are willing to come forth and tell on other cops, you got to protect them. I don't care anywhere in the United States. If you're going against that blue wall of silence, you've got to have protections. You cannot have law enforcement for 30 years with a lawsuit that this has gone on for 30 years and you expect all of a sudden to just throw something simple out there and say, let's just let it go and not hold managers accountable. I want managers to be held accountable and the hierarchy to be held accountable so this never happens again. So we've got these things on the plate and we want people to understand that that if you go to my website, again, support us, support the Black Marshals, what we're trying to do. Let us know you're in our corner and that what I'm saying makes sense. I mean, the bottom line is you can have racism, bigotry internally with a executive order out there, and yet you want it to be effective. It's just not going to happen.
So there's another website for those who are listening by audio. It is linked from, you can go to vspats.net, which is my website, and I have put up a number of the links that Marshall Fogg has shared over the last couple of weeks and years. And you can find more information to investigate more of this on your own. And you can find a link to the bigots with badges, a link to the 7 points that were listed at the press conference on June 7th. And there's other, I can put more information and we can try to make sure that people are informed about that. And there's also a press conference that you can listen to Marshall Fogg's remarks and to somebody who was speaking to the issue of the police can't be sued. You just said,
oh yeah, it. Qualified immunity.
There was a speaker about qualified immunity. There were other community members from the DC area and from up and down the East Coast at that conference. And will there be, do you know yet if there's going to be another date for a conference, or people should just, is there a website or a mailing list they can join?
Well, what I'll do is, yeah, and that's what I'll have them to go through you, Virginia, as well as come to bigotswithbadges.com, and we'll post it on that website to let people know when the next press conference is going to be. Because I think what we want to do now is address this recent issue of the Jennings.
The Jennings case, I believe it did happen in 2021.
Right.
And I'm not sure when the...
It came out yesterday.
Okay.
It came out yesterday. Okay. They did a press release on it yesterday.
Okay. And, you know, we have also had... we're still waiting for the report, whatever it's going to be, on the Alante Scott case.
Right.
He was shot on the 28th of February, and MPD, that is Metropolitan Police Department for DC, has been somehow put in charge of investigating this.
Right.
And I did check with MPD and they said they can't say anything about the actual marshals who were involved. They don't ever tell anybody's names until the release, but then they can't say anything about whether they're going to release the information. And as you said, they're the ones that have body cam footage and should be able to share that, but our mayor...
Well, not body cam, but the cameras overbooked because the marshals weren't wearing body cameras.
Okay.
Those who were on the scene, the camera footage comes from all of the cameras that were placed in the complex area around.
Okay. And in any case, MPD, their spokesperson told me that they basically are investigating. They won't say anything till the investigation is finished.
Right.
But meanwhile, they have said nothing to the community. And, you know, we only have a couple minutes left. And one of the things that I want to kind of close with is that because they're not saying anything and because this continues to go on, how do people who are in the most affected communities feel safe, or feel that their young people are safe? And, you know, what?
Well, the violence in law enforcement is a fact. And there was a report done on the U.S. Marshals Service saying the marshals are more violent than any other law enforcement. And you'll be able to see that when you go to Virginia's site of mine. We have those articles up. The problem is when you're talking about deadly force, or you're talking about simply just locking somebody, and I tell people it's not deadly force. It's all of the people that we arrest, falsely arrest, or accuse of things that didn't do it or change the evidence. That's racism. That's ingrained in the U.S. Marshals and a lot of law enforcement departments. Black lives just don't matter. So I spoke about it. I won a case. I proved it. It exists in the U.S. model. And instead of them fixing it, they allowed us to drag on to where we are today. So only thing I can tell you is just get involved, you know, write your congressman, write the congressman's, the U.S. Congress leaders up on my website. You'll see what our lawyers wrote to Congress about the racial aspect of this case meaning the class action lasting for so many years. And how in the world can you expect justice for the citizens? You can't. So yes, you have a right to be afraid, concerned, that, you know, if we can't get it right, And this executive order doesn't get it right. You know, you've got a right to be concerned. You really do.
Okay, so we're going to have to leave it at that. You've been listening to the voice of Dr. Matthew Fogg, Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal, retired. He was in the service for 30 years and has been speaking out for at least that long. And I'm Virginia Avniel Spatz for We Act Radio, saying tune in next time. And meanwhile, peace.